a little bit about the larger context of doing metta meditation. And I know many of you have some very practical questions about your practice, which we'll also get to. If we go back to the way that metta works, the way it affects us, as I said yesterday, it is said to transform the field of intention from which we operate. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of intention according to the Buddha's teaching. In any given action, according to that perspective, we might see three primary different aspects, three main aspects. The first is the intention, the heart space, the motivation that gives rise to the action. Whether we say something or we do something, we give somebody something, there's an intention that is giving rise to it. And this is really considered quite crucial. It's the intention that gives the action its energy. Classically, we would say that's the karmic seed, is in the intention. It's the intention that differentiates one action from another, even though physically, objectively, concretely, it looks like exactly the same thing. So, for example, here's my prop. Say I wanted to give one of you this book. There are many, many different spaces within me that could be giving rise to this action. Maybe I'm giving you the book because I like you and I want you to have it. Or maybe I'm giving you the book because you have a book I want and I think, oh, good, you know. I'll give you this one and you'll give me that one maybe. Or maybe I'm giving you the book because I'm here in front of a room full of people and I want everyone to think I'm a splendidly generous person. They're all kind of different actions, even though all anybody sees from the outside is a hand moving down, lifting up an object, and moving it forward. That's why the intention is considered, it's where the juice is, it's where the energy is, because that's what differentiates one hand moving it forward from the same hand moving it forward at a different time. So intention, knowing our intention, changing our intentions, is considered one of the most powerful things we can do, because that changes everything. That is really where the energy is. It's also said, interestingly, that no one else can know our intentions but us. You know, we ourselves. We might project. Some people are very sensitive. They might really get a feeling for where someone else is coming from. But in the end, only we can really know. So that takes a great deal of mindfulness. I don't know if you've ever had the experience. I like to think it's not just me that's had this experience, where you're talking to somebody and you know a really nasty bit of gossip about somebody else and you feel the urge to disclose it. You can feel it like bubbling up in you. But if you're mindful and you take the time to look at that which is bubbling up in you, then you have a choice. You can say, as I often do say when I feel that urge, what will this serve? You know, will this really benefit anybody? Or what harm might this cause if I just say this thing? If we can make more of a habit of tuning into our intentions, those urges, that heart space which precedes an action, whether it's verbal or physical, we will have choice. We will have some empowerment to know what we're feeling, to know what we want. Last week, I think it was last week, I was somewhere where there was a workshop going on people, for people trying to bring yoga into the public school system. And I talked about meditation for children. And several people in the group had been trying to bring meditation to children in one form or another. And they emphasized this very point that when the child can know what they're feeling and be comfortable sitting with the feeling, then they see they don't necessarily have to act it out. And that is very empowering, to realize we have a choice. But that takes a great deal of mindfulness. And they actually said they found the kids better than adults often at being able to do that, which is not in some ways that big a surprise. To be able to sit with our feelings, to accompany them, to accommodate them, to hang out with them, rather than have them necessarily drive us to action in a way we might later regret. That's the nature of mindfulness. And it's said that that field of intention, as we say, can be actually transfigured through practices like loving kindness. That's what we're doing when we plant those seeds. So that if, in general, we have been coming from a place of fear, of anger, of separation, of jealousy, of comparing, then, in general, we will start to come from a place of connection and care. That's what happens. That's how these practices work, particularly the first three of the Brahma-Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. That's why even if you don't feel a great wild rush of feeling while you're sitting, this is what we're actually doing. It's working with transfiguring the field of intention. Okay, so intention is the first aspect of action. The second aspect of action is the skillfulness or the unskillfulness with which we act. And this has to do with mindfulness again, but in a broader context. It has to do with sensitivity, with learning how to listen, learning from our mistakes. So here again, back to the same example. If out of a beautiful, truly generous motivation, I want to give one of you this book, I might stop and think, well, wait a minute. There's only one book. There's a lot of people in this room. There are a lot of people in this room. Maybe this is the kind of action best done privately. Maybe that would be the most skillful thing to do. We try to pay attention to context, to as big a picture as we can discern. We listen and we learn. So here again, there's an aspect of action we can be continually transforming. We can get more and more skillful as we pay more and more attention. Now, one thing that's important to distinguish here in terms of metta practice is that coming from a more connected, loving, caring space does not determine the action that we're going to take. What determines the skillfulness or the unskillfulness of the action is our wisdom, our discernment, our best guess at the context in which we find ourselves, at what might prove most helpful. But this is a fear that many people have, that coming from a loving or a compassionate motivation will shrink down the avenue of options available in terms of action so that the world gets very small. You know, somebody hits you and you can only smile because, after all, you want to be coming from a loving place. You know, you can't say no, you can't set limits, you can't try to protect yourself, you can't try to make change in the world, because coming from a loving place couldn't allow that. Those are the kinds of ideas that people have. So I think it's an important conceptual understanding to realize that to come from a loving or compassionate place is the energy that is guiding our action, and what we do or what we say is really based on as much mindfulness or wisdom as we can gather. This is the example I used yesterday when I talked about the woman who gave a whole bunch of money to this street person. And I said, there are a lot of different reasons why one might decide or not decide not to or to give money. You know, that is different from having that recognition that that person's life and mine have something to do with one another. That vision of life, that perception, is what guides our intention, our motivation. What form our action takes is based on something else. I think this is just very, very crucial to understand, because we can be so afraid of coming from a loving place, or we can be so confused about what that will mean and feel that it's just an impossible way to live and a wrong way to live. Whereas really, I think developing more mindfulness, developing more loving kindness will open our world. We will have many options, because we will not be caught in that sort of tunnel vision we can get caught in. And still, the energy can be what it is. When we say no, when we take a stand, when we try to create change, it doesn't have to be from a place of hatred or separation or a great sense of us and them or self and other. It can be coming from a different place, genuinely. And we try to make change. I mean, the great common example, you've probably heard this many, many times, because almost every Vipassana teacher that I know uses this story, but it actually is a story, is my story. And so I used to listen to people tell the story and think, that's my story. And a great act of sympathetic joy. It was about this time when I was living in India and living in a town called Bodh Gaya, which is the town that grew up around the tree the Buddha was sitting under when he became the Buddha, when he became enlightened. I was living in Bodh Gaya, and I'd gone to Calcutta with a friend to visit somebody. And then in leaving Calcutta, I wasn't able to get a taxi. There was some like riot on the street or something like that, and I couldn't get a taxi, so this friend and I jumped into a rickshaw, which in Calcutta was a man actually pulling this cart running along, and the cart kind of zigzagged and went its way, and then he went down these side streets and down these alleys, and a very large, very drunken man stepped out of the shadows and grabbed him to stop him, and then grabbed me to pull me off the rickshaw. And I was, of course, terrified. And the friend I was with managed to push this man away, and we got the rickshaw person to start running again with the cart, and we got to the train station safely. And I was really shaken up and very distraught. And the next morning, I saw my teacher, one of my teachers, a man named Manindra, and I was telling this whole story and how I felt, and he said to me, "Oh, Sharon, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you should have taken that umbrella and hit that man over the head." You know, you should have taken your umbrella and hit that man over the head. That's my story. But we often don't think of that. You know, we think, I mean, it's easier to take our umbrella and hit that man over the head without all the loving kindness in our hearts, or to have work to have all the loving kindness in our hearts and can't imagine that an action like that might ensue. Yet the world is richer, more intricate, more complicated, more mysterious than we often paint a picture of. So we have intention, which is the energetic component of the action. We have the skillfulness or unskillfulness, which is the best we can do based on mindfulness, on wisdom, on discernment, on understanding, on sensitivity. And then we have the third aspect, which is really the immediate result, particularly in terms of what the Buddha described as praise and blame. He talked about life having eight vicissitudes of pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. He said, this is the very fabric of life. There is no one who has only pleasure and no pain. And there's no one who has only gain and no loss. And there's no one who has only praise and no blame. He said, there's always blame in this world. And the story behind that, which I've always liked a lot, is the story of a man in the Buddha's time who went to the monastery to learn something of what the Buddha taught. And the first person he came upon was a monk who had taken a temporary vow of silence. So when the man asked him, will you tell me something of what the Buddha teaches, the monk remained silent, and the man became furious and he stomped away. The second day, the same man came up to the Buddha's monastery, came upon another disciple of the Buddha's, somebody who was quite renowned for his very deep theoretical understanding as well as his great practice. So when this monk was asked, will you tell me something of the Buddha's teaching, it said he went into a very long, elaborate discourse, and the man became furious and he stomped away. Same man came back a third day from the monastery, came upon yet another disciple of the Buddha, this monk named Ananda. It said that Ananda, having heard what happened on the first day and heard what happened on the second day, was careful to say something, but not too much. And the man became really angry. He said something like, how dare you treat such profound matters so sketchily? And he stomped away. So this group of people went up to see the Buddha and they said, oh Lord Buddha, this is what happened on the first day. This is what happened on the second day. This is what happened on the third day. What do you have to say? And the Buddha said, there's always blame in this world. If you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. There's always blame in this world. And that's interesting because of those three arenas, the intention, the skillfulness, and the result, in terms of praise and blame, it's the result that's the one area we can't do anything about. Because we can become more mindful and transform our intentions. We can learn to be more and more skillful. But in this third area, it actually is the way it is. Because after all, if out of a beautiful motivation I wanted to give you that book, and I thought about it really carefully, I figured out the circumstance, I decided to try to do it in a particular way because it seemed most skillful, I wrapped it, I took you aside, and I offered you the book, but you were, you know, in a really bad mood. And, you know, as I said yesterday, where you found out that you just won $10 million in the lottery, and I give you the book, and you kind of nod distantly and go away. What does that mean about my heart? What does that mean about my generosity? What does that mean about my gift? Nothing. But it's the one area that we actually count on the most for us to know who we are and how we did and if we deserve to be happy. What is our integrity? And ironically, it's the one of the three we actually can't affect all that much. Because really, what do you say to somebody? Well, something's going to happen at 20 after 10. So please come, not having checked your messages, not having had any conversations, not having thought about anything. You know, arrive at that moment in time, a completely blank slate. It's not going to happen. Every encounter, every moment, every experience is really all of us coming together on a sea of conditions. That's what it is. That's our lives. We're not in control. And we need to be relating with wisdom. But that doesn't mean to imply, or I don't mean to imply, you know, that that's a kind of coldness or indifference or, you know, that that we don't care. I mean, of course we care as a human being. We want praise. We don't want blame. But the question becomes, how much do we care? Do we care enough so that we are devastated? So that we don't take even a moment and look back and say, what was my intention? Or did I do that as skillfully as I could? We're so fixated, we're so stuck on that last arena, the hopeless one. You know, that we're continually, it's like our hearts continually break in a way that isn't going to lead us onward, because we can't learn, we can't change that reaction. I always point to those instances where we receive both praise and blame for the very same action, because it's a great learning. You know, we do something from whatever motivation is leading us forward with as much skillfulness as we can. One person reacts one way, another person may react a completely different way. And that's just how it is. You know, my favorite story about that is this time when my first book, Loving Kindness, had just come out. And it took me quite a long time to write that book. Those of you who have, especially the original hardcover, and read the blurbs, the comments on the back, certainly get that flavor, you know, where somebody said, we've waited a long time for this book, and someone else said, in this long-awaited first book, and someone else had actually said, Sharon Salzberg has finally given us, and I made the publisher take out finally. I just couldn't bear it anymore, but you know, it took me a long time to write that book. And not too long after it came out, I was in California and having lunch with somebody who said to me, oh, Sharon, reading that book is just like being with you. It's like sitting down and having a conversation with you. And I was so moved by that. I thought, what a fantastic thing to say. You know, I couldn't imagine better praise. And I was so jazzed by that comment that when I had dinner that night with a whole other group of people, I brought it up. And someone at the dinner table said, that's not true. She said, I'm reading that book. It's nothing like being with you. It doesn't sound like you at all. So I said, okay. You can either be ecstatic at lunch and depressed at dinner, or you can take a moment and think, remind yourself, it's just one book. You know, written from whatever was guiding me or motivating me at the time, with as much skill as I could bring forth. It was just one book. Now, I don't want to imply in any way I didn't notice the difference between lunch and dinner, you know, between how I felt and then how I felt later. I mean, of course we care. But think of the anguish that we get into between lunch and dinner. You know, and how devastated we feel and how we discard any good we might have done, or, you know, all the ways that we take it so to heart, as though we could have controlled it, as though if we'd only done it better, there would have been only praise and never any blame. And that's delusion or confusion. So if we practice loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, we will transform our field of motivation. As we practice mindfulness, we'll learn to be more and more skillful. And as we practice equanimity, which is balance of mind, we will understand that which we can't control, that things are the way that they are, that life goes up and down. This is very important in bringing the practice of metta into life, into our action, to realize it's not going to limit our options in terms of how we act, to realize that we may want someone to become happy, we may want them to be free of suffering. Maybe it's not going to happen. You know, can we still be present with balance? Can the equanimity allow us to in fact be giving a freely given gift rather than one of conditionality? There's so many times when I teach loving kindness retreats where maybe I'll then be in New York City or someplace and I'll run into somebody who had sat the retreat and they'll say, you know, I'm really frustrated. You know, I sat up in Barrie for like a week or a month or whatever it was, and I had this one friend, and I sent them metta, and then I saw them, and they're no better than they were before, you know. And I thought, I gave you a week, you know, like, why aren't you better? Or we care about someone who's really in pain, and it's not going away, and there's no way we can fix it. We can't maneuver them out of it. How are we with that understanding? You know, do we withdraw? Do we cut them off? Does our own helplessness become the predominant emotion in that moment? Or can we be present? Can we be connected? Fortified by the understanding that, yeah, I'm not in control. That's the way all of these practices support one another. And even if you do just one, literally as a technique, even if you just do loving kindness, it's with the vision and the energy of all of them to work in this way. So do you have any questions about any of this before we get on to practice questions? Okay, the question was, could I talk a little more about the experience of metta, because she's been practicing metta and feels a sense of openness and connection which has been sustained. Does that fit in with my saying that feelings come and go? And I think it does fit in with saying feelings come and go. You know, when I talk about it doesn't matter what you feel as you do the practice, it doesn't mean that it has no effect, you know, or that we don't have feelings at times in the conventional sense of feelings, or that there isn't a quality of connection that comes apart from the emotional arisings and passings away. I think there definitely is. You know, there's even in that example I used of my friend going to visit the Karmapa, you know, there's a sense of presence, of recognition, of listening, of connection, that is very different than a kind of warm rush of sentiment, you know, that's like, woo, you know, which is often what people are looking for, and that's why they get so discouraged, and it's so painful, because there may not be that, but that doesn't mean nothing is happening. You know, the most profound level, I think, on which something is happening is the one of transforming our intentions, you know, and that is based on how we see the world. And the metta will also change how we see the world, as will the vipassana. So, you know, back to that example of the woman walking by the street person whom I had just walked by, you know, there was something in her vision of life that included him that led to a motivation of wanting to connect in a specific way, you know, to be generous. One can well have that same vision of life and come to a different conclusion about the appropriate action, you know, but that sense would be there. And that's one of the reasons I like teaching metta in non-residential settings, especially in cities, a little even more urban than this, you know. Although this is wonderful too, just because there are so many encounters one has as you're out doing walking that kind of bring that same point home again and again. And people often say, well, you know, I passed this guy sitting on the sidewalk and it's the first time I ever recognized that's a human being. You know, I went by this group of people, And I actually paid attention to them. You know, just the things like that that are really the fruit of the practice. So. The question was about doing walking meditation and seeing a spontaneous arising of different phrases with different people as they went walking by. And I mean, I think that's fine. You know, again, there's usually a balance. The simpler things are, the more easily we will concentrate. But you don't want to be imprisoned by that. You know, the more kind of pertinent and relevant things are, like the phrases, the more it will capture our attention, the more interesting it will be. And so what you described seems perfectly fine to me. What you don't want is to sort of stand still looking at the person saying, now should I say this or should I say that? You know, to have it be contrived in some way. But as long as it was natural, it's great.
So the other question.
The question is, what are the ethics of telling someone you've been doing metta for them? I find that interesting too, because certainly I say it to people who, you know, are in trouble in some way. They're having surgery or they have some trouble in their life, and usually people ask, actually, will you do metta for me? And I say yes, you know, or I'll say, I heard about your situation and I did metta for you, and it's very supportive. Some teachers have said, you know, don't tell them, you know. And I think that's not because it's wrong to tell them, because they want us, the student, the person doing the practice, to see if the relationship changes just by virtue of one person having done that. I often wonder about saying to somebody, oh, you were my neutral person, you know, because just in terms of social etiquette, it's like saying, I found you absolutely neutral when I met you. I wasn't drawn to you at all. You know, so I think you can just see, according to the circumstance, how it, you know, what seems appropriate. The comment was about earlier yesterday, she had said something about doing metta for another person felt like it was interfering in their lives, but later in the day she realized the metta is really done for one's own transformation, and then it's not to kind of fix the situation. I think that's right. You know, I would just add to that, you know, what I said yesterday is that I don't think it's nothing in terms of the other person. You know, I think it is an energetic gift. The interference comes in if we get attached, like, well, they have to take that gift and enjoy it, you know, and or they have to take that gift and thank me, or they have to take that gift and then change in these five ways, you know, because that we don't know. That's where we really need equanimity. We need balance of mind. You know, so it's somewhere, for me anyway, you know, in my understanding, something like, you know, the primary power of the practice is in our own transformation, and it's an energy that can or might not be influential. But I think everyone has to come to their own, you know, feeling about that second part. The question is, could I describe the relationship between the practice of metta and the practice of tonglen, which is a Tibetan practice? Where one breathes in the difficulty, suffering, distress of others, and breathes out kind of a metta-filled energy. I can't really, because I've only practiced tonglen for like an hour, you know, or something, so I would really not want to do that in a comparative basis. I know it's a very people have described it as a very powerful practice, and say that they've gotten a lot from it. But it needs to be done also with some very direct guidance, you know. But one can intuit the similarities, you know, that there is that ability to offer, you know, to express the loving heart in that way of actually making an offering of connecting. Yeah. The question is about, this one I can't answer, about the connection between metta and the other three Brahma-viharas and how they support one another, how they're different, and the phraseology. The four, as you may recall, are metta or loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And each can be known in terms of the Buddhist psychology in terms of different aspects. One is called the far enemy. That's the clear opposite. I mean, you'd never mistake the two, you know. The other is called the near enemy, which is a state that is close enough to the Brahma-vihara so that we can get confused, so that it might masquerade as the Brahma-vihara, but it's not really the same at all. And another aspect is called the proximate cause. The far enemy of metta is, you could say, hatred or anger or fear, since interestingly, in the Buddhist psychology, anger and fear are exactly the same mind state. There's the outflowing, energized form, which is anger. There's the imploded, frozen form, which is fear. The near enemy of metta is attachment. It's close, but it's not really the same because of that conditionality, that dependence on control, things not changing. And the proximate cause is, as you know, I mentioned yesterday, seeing the good in someone. Or, if that is not a possibility, it's that reflection that all beings want to be happy, that we share that. Compassion, the far enemy, is cruelty. The near enemy is sometimes translated as pity, sometimes as grief or sorrow. And you have to understand what that means. It's not maybe the way we would use the word in contemporary psychological terms, but it means a state of actually being shattered by the suffering we see, being overcome by it or broken by it. Because if that's what happens, then we actually don't have the energy to try to make a difference. We're just overcome by our own pain or distress. And so that's the near enemy of compassion. And the proximate cause is seeing suffering, is opening to suffering. Sympathetic joy, taking delight in the happiness of others. The far enemy is jealousy or envy. The near enemy, I've also seen translated in different ways. One is giddiness. It's just being happy for no good reason, not necessarily because you're seeing other people's happiness. And the other way I've seen it is comparing. You know, because in sympathetic joy, we do have to look at other people's happiness. Where in comparing, we do as well, but in a different way. A much more restless, gnawing way. And the proximate cause is opening to joy. It's looking at joy. Equanimity, the far enemy, is reactivity, you know, grasping and aversion. The near enemy is indifference. It's not indifference, but it's easy to make that mistake. And, excuse me? The near enemy is indifference. And the proximate cause is also can be seen in different ways. It's seeing the nature of things. You know, there's pleasure and pain and gain and loss. And it also can be seen as seeing a kind of equality amongst beings, that we're all subject to. Well, just as we all want to be happy, we're all vulnerable to pain, to loss, to blame, and so on. The particular way equanimity supports the others is that it keeps them from falling into their near enemy. Because equanimity is like wisdom. It's the voice of wisdom. So we will know the difference between metta and attachment, for example. And we will actually be able to be practicing metta rather than attachment. You know, like get happy tonight or something like that. That's the particular way equanimity will support all of them. Compassion and sympathetic joy support each other because one is based on opening to suffering, the other is based on opening to joy. And if we only open to suffering, we are likely to fall apart, you know, to really get out of balance, to feel overcome. If we only open to joy, then we're likely to live in a very narrow, little guarded world, you know, that is unreal. And so being able to open to both provides a kind of balance, and they're both important in that way. Metta is a way of capturing all of it. You know, you can do all of those practices through the practice of metta, and bring in that those understandings and those insights and those particular energetic components, you know, of all of them into the practice of metta. So there we are. Yeah. Was when we're practicing metta and we encounter an emotion or a feeling, what do we do? Do we go back to mindfulness or do we keep doing the metta? And usually it's like a graded process. We have different options, you know, and none of them are wrong. But because it's a concentration practice, I'd say the first thing to do is try to go back to the metta. You know, to gently see if you can let go of the emotion and go back to the metta. Maybe the emotion is too strong for that. You know, it might be time for you to do metta for yourself, especially if it's a difficult emotion, you know, to be developing some compassion for yourself with that. But if it's too strong even for that, then let go of the metta, you know, and just sit and be mindful. That's a perfectly fine thing to do. So it's kind of stages, you know, like one, if one doesn't work, you try two, if two doesn't work, you try three, you know, and that's fine. It's absolutely fine. The question was around sending metta to somebody a little more difficult or maybe a lot more difficult than I had suggested, somebody who'd really harmed us, and the feeling that one has to do it because that needs to change, you know, that holding on or that pain from that. And do I think that will change from doing the metta? And yes, I do think it will change from doing the metta. And but it's the kind of thing you can't force yourself into, you know, or be very judgmental about. Because, you know, if you go back to metta being the antidote to fear, so many times fear is a component in those situations. And we want to be able to move beyond the fear. But that doesn't mean we get stupid, you know. In the great quotation, there's a wonderful Indian saint named Karoli Baba Maharaji, who was Ram Dass's guru, who had this saying where he said, never throw anyone out of your heart. Never throw anyone out of your heart. And my friend Sylvia Borstein, one of my colleagues, had a kind of addendum to that. She said, never throw anyone out of your heart. You may throw them out of your life, but never throw them out of your heart. You know, so, which is another wonderful example of what I was just trying to explain, you know, like, we may hold them in our hearts in a different place, but that doesn't mean the action that we take will make us vulnerable to being hurt again, or will be foolish, or, you know. So there are lots of options with that. For the transformation of our own hearts, yes, the metta will work, but in its own time and in its own way. So you don't want the burden, you know, of, well, I've got to make it okay, or this isn't working. Sometimes it's working, we don't even know it's working. You know, I have a friend who once sat, I don't know if the situation is one where you would encounter the person or not, you know, but I have a friend who sat in Barrie and was offering loving kindness to this difficult person who was his former business partner in a firm, a law firm that had broken up very acrimoniously with a lot of bad feeling. And he said he chose this person as his difficult person, was offering him a lot of metta and felt nothing. Then the course ended and he went home. There were further meetings to negotiate the breakup of the firm. And this guy came into the office and he said, he looked up and said, "Hi, how are you?" And the guy said, "Is that you?" You know, because it was the first time in like forever there had been a more human exchange. Not so guarded, not so positional. Things had changed without him realizing that they had changed. So often it's like that, you know, or you will feel in time. You just don't want to be stuck there anymore. You know, that there's some movement. Yeah, it will work. Okay, why don't we...